Jeff Redfern, this, The Great War and Modern Memory. I showed this to my mum and we both agreed the picture on the front looked like my granddad, who was very fortunate to got, in 1915, got from those, a blighty, he got his arm shot up so he didn't have to go back. And so that's why I'm here today. But then I looked at it and thought, no, every photograph of troops in the First World War looked like my granddad actually. I think it's just something about those kind of photographs. This morning, we were pretty spot on with the timing, maybe about 30 seconds late, a minute late, but this morning the representatives of the armed services, politicians and the royal family will have gathered at the cenotaph in Whitehall to lay their wreaths. The last post will have been sounded, the 2 minute silence solemnly kept, and then the silence brightly broken by Reveille. And in Westminster Abbey, I guess, flowers or wreaths will be laid on the tomb of the unknown soldier. So far so familiar, and it's fairly unchanging except for the occasional diversion of some red paint on Winston Churchill's head, or for those of you who remember Michael Foot's famous donkey jacket, which caused great furore back in about 1981 perhaps. As familiar are the memorials to the war dead in every church, town, city and village. There's even a couple of plaques up here. And none of us can remember a time when these monuments were not there or this ceremony was not held. And I'm a veteran of them. I'm not a veteran of war, but I'm a veteran of Remembrance Sundays. And the scout uniform of my youth consisted of shorts and short sleeve shirts. And we were definitely not permitted to cover our uniform with coats or jumpers or long trousers. So we used to shiver our way across the town to the memorial while the flags were dipped as the last post sounded. Some of the boys contrived careful ways of wearing a jumper with the arms rolled up underneath the shirt. And I really can't remember what happened when it rained. I guess we must have been allowed to wear coats, but the scout masters were very unkeen, and to be fair to them, they wore shorts as well, so all long gone. There we are. And as familiar as this iconography of remembrance, that ironically we forget that it once didn't exist, these ceremonies, these monuments. The landscape of Britain is not littered with monuments to the Civil War, although its cost in life and expression of savagery was proportionate to those of the 20th century, and there are few memorials to the Napoleonic Wars, though had you been around in 1816, most towns in the UK would have had their cannon-mutilated veterans begging on the streets. No carbon fibre prosthetics for them. The scum of the earth enlisted for drink, as Wellington kindly described the ordinary ranks, the heroes of the Peninsular War and Waterloo. And of course, as familiar, so familiar is it all, that it risks the fate of all very familiar things, if not exactly contempt, then quite possibly indifference. What relevance does this all have to me? A ceremony devised nearly 100 years ago to commemorate a war of which there are now no living survivors. Far from being a reproach to slaughter, is its solemnity not perhaps rather a covert and gloomy salute to the bloody glamour of war? Even the iconography of remembrance is heavy with death. The scarlet poppies of Flanders, the cenotaph, which literally means empty tomb, which was a proxy for the real anonymous resting places of the millions of dead. The 2 minutes, which we kept this morning between the last post and Reveille, is symbolic of the night watch, when the living soldiers would try to salvage the bodies of the dead, or at least protect them from further atrocity. The unknown soldier, elevated to the status of a dead general or king, honourably entombed in cold stone in the abbey. Isn't it all rather morbid and bleak, this public poetry of sacrifice and glory, and they will not grow old as we grow old? Is it perhaps just a hypocritical sham and an evasion, a collective denial of the failure and culpability of human governance? Even in 1920, Some old soldiers found all the public solemnity a bit sickening. After all, they'd won and they'd survived and thought a knees up was more in order than an annual wake. And we, as a religious movement with our roots in radical dissent from the establishment, who wish to see peace and justice and human equality made real on the earth, what can it mean for us? We look to the great seers, to philosophers and thinkers who have brought new enlightenment and consciousness to human experience. And we tend to be wary of populist views, especially when endorsed by politicians and the military. So why should we continue to keep this Remembrance Sunday? Well, I think there are very many good reasons, and not least, of course, is that young British servicemen and women are still being killed in war. Whatever we might think about the justice of these wars, our hearts can't but go out to their families, and we must surely acknowledge their courage, their being prepared to risk everything with so much life still before them. But I want also to consider the role this ceremony may have played in helping society heal and move forward after the calamity that was the Great War. It has been said that the fundamental crisis of bereavement arises not so much from the loss of the one who has died, but from the loss of self. In the reading from C.S. Lewis, we have a glimpse of this as he struggles with the absolute devastation of loss. As well as her own self, his departed wife has taken a great chunk of his sense of self and meaning with her when she dies. Lewis says, "I didn't know grief felt so much like fear." Grief like this is like a great aching void that seems impossible to fill, and into which any energy to go on in life seems to vanish, sucked down and back always towards the departed one. Such grief must have been experienced by most British families by the end of the Great War. So great was the death toll, nearly 1 million British men alone. But apart from the individual grieving of families, the nation itself had a sort of collective sense of grief, a collective collapse of self-understanding and meaning. We heard in the first reading how Edmund Blunden symbolically dates this loss of hope, this collective disillusionment, to that ghastly first day in July 1916 on the Somme, when he realised that no one was winning or going to win, only war had won. It's a cliché of the 20th century history, but probably true, that something died in European culture and society in the Great War that could never be recaptured. A sense of trust in the essential reliability and timeless stability of the social, political and religious order. Things were wrong with society, that was true, but human endeavour, the tide of history and the hand of God were working together towards such change that was needed. That optimism, that security vanished in the mud of the trenches, and indeed, in spite of all our present day prosperity, perhaps has never really been recovered. Lewis's book poignantly shows him working through his grief and one day arriving at the moment where the awful heaviness seems to lift a little. Something begins to change, he says. Suddenly, at the very moment I mourned my wife least, I remembered her best. And from that moment, his faith in God begins to return. His sense of his self becomes gradually restored. Maybe he will be able to live again without her. Not the same, for sure, as he was before he married. This is not a going back. He actually tries to recapture the pleasure of his old bachelor ways, but only finds it hollow and depressing. This is about being able to go forward with the memory of his wife somehow now transformed and integrated into his heart. Instead of grief draining him, somehow his remembrance of her now gives him something. His sense of purpose is no longer crippled by her loss, but enabled by his memory of their marriage. And I would suggest to you that something similar was being enacted in the ceremonies and rituals of remembrance that sprang up after the Great War. And not only the ceremonies, the 20s produced that great stream of memoirs by Robert Graves and Edmund Blunden and Sassoon, and many others that count among the greatest and most radical literature of the 20th century. I still find that the film of remarks, All Quiet on the Western Front, is one of the most moving films ever made. So with Lewis, as with Lewis, so with post-war society, as remembrance became integrated, so new meanings and purposes were imagined into life and then worked with. The public remembrance of the dead gave something to the process by which the depressing emptiness of their sacrifice became changed into something that would lend meaning to the future endeavours of the living. Now, many of these endeavours were not what the establishment wanted. Then, as now, remembrance was for them a harking back to the old days of deference, of privilege and security. Perhaps the blood of the fallen was a sacrifice to appease the god's anger so that all would be restored to a golden age. Was that Winston Churchill's fantasy when he reintroduced the gold standard, nicely wrecking the post-war economy in the process? But just as Lewis found, for society there was no going back. New movements and ideas were born. Things that people had been struggling for before the war became possible. Women's suffrage, the League of Nations, disarmament, the spread of democracy across Europe, pacifism, anti-colonialism, the new social freedoms and new developments in the arts. Now, it's true that many of these needed another war to bring them properly to fruition. And it's true that some of the seeds that were nurtured were not so good, fascism and Stalinism being only two. But even these had in them that idea, so long held, but given new impetus by the great democracy of the slaughter of the trenches, that the commonwealth of a nation was to be for the enjoyment and participation of everyone, not just the privileged few. Every year, people gathered at these memorials on this Remembrance Day, and yes, certainly visited again their personal grief, but they also gathered in remembrance of what had been so tragically learned in the folly of the trenches, that it is the duty of all adults to question, to doubt, to think for themselves, to hold those in power to account, and if necessary, be able to peacefully remove them from power. They kept this time of remembrance because they now recognised the truth in that old aphorism, those who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. And so today we also gather to remember the dead of our wars and to stand in solidarity with the grief of the families of the women and men killed in the conflicts of our own times. In this we honour them, both in our acknowledgement of their courage and commitment, and yet we can also honour them in our own commitment to questioning and doubting and being prepared to show courage in serving the cause of truth and justice and universal human freedom and peace. We owe this at least to the memories of those who have died in war, and we owe this to the generations to come.